Janie couldn't see his face in the gloom, even so close to hers, but she could hear the smile in Mr. Burke's voice. Ever practical. She knew she shouldn't, but the compulsion was too strong. Janie put a hand up to touch his face. Her finger grazed his lip. How odd that a man's lips should be so soft. His cheek was lightly stubbled against her palm.
You're mocking me.
He caught her hand in his, too tightly. Don't they say we mock what we most admire? Janie shook her head, feeling the wall behind her chignon, her hair catching on the cracks in the paper.
I've never heard that.
You have now. Her hand was still caught in his, suspended in space. With his free hand, Mr. Burke traced the line of a stray lock of hair, tucking it back behind her ear. His knuckle brushed her cheek. We mock what we can't have. Janie's brain didn't quite want to work. The world had narrowed to the tiny square of hallway, to Mr. Burke's fingers against her cheek, to the powerful grip of his fingers around hers. This wasn't happening. This wasn't her. She was somewhere else entirely, in her cold bed in town, or sitting in a chair by the library, dreaming a whiskey-soaked dream. But it certainly felt real. Mr. Burke's hand around hers, his breath against her cheek, the warmth of him, the scent of him. She meant to say something clever, but her voice wouldn't work properly. Her hand was against Mr. Burke's chest. She could feel every fiber of his coat beneath her fingers, every fold and wrinkle. Mr. Burke's fingers tangled in the thickness of her chignon, and there was no more room for anything but the feeling of his lips against hers in the chill dark of the abandoned house. Tarrytown, 1894. October.
You may kiss the bride.
Teddy Newland turned the requisite peck into something a little less traditional, provoking titters and raised eyebrows and more than one discreet harumph.
What would you expect?
One dowager trumpeted to another behind Georgie. What indeed? Georgie had expected to feel relief at Anne's wedding, but mostly she felt queasy. The festivities had been held at Teddy's family home, the Knoll. Private trains had ferried the guests from Grand Central to the local station, where they had been met with ribbon-bedecked carriages driven by liveried coachmen, who had taken them to a village church decked with a fortune in orchids. There had been something more than a little disconcerting about watching Bay deliver his cousin down the aisle, her arm tucked in his. Georgie could hear the whispers, see the heads turning. Carrie Rhinelander had done her work well. Everything was too much. Too many bridesmaids milling about with flowers in their hair, too many jewels, too much perfume. The whispers were too loud, the music too bold. Even the sunlight slanting through the stained glass seemed too bright. The toasts at the wedding luncheon seemed to go on forever, although Georgie couldn't make herself concentrate on them. Mouths open, lips moving, forks laden with food. The scent of the lobster mousse made her gag. Georgie set down her fork, hoping no one would notice. She nibbled on bread instead, and choked down the champagne without tasting it. Her stomach wouldn't seem to settle, no matter what she did. "Are you all right?" It was her husband, appearing behind her chair.
"It's very close in here," said Georgie.
It was true. The dining room was large, but the windows had been closed, and the scent of hothouse flowers was overpowering. Georgie could smell them slowly rotting, like funeral flowers strewn on a grave. Fancies. Fancies and foolishness. Her dress was laced too tight, that was all. She'd wanted to put on a good show today for Bay. And for herself.
"Shall we seek some air?"
suggested Bay. And Georgie nodded wordlessly, not trusting herself to open her mouth. The terrace was deserted, save for a handful of smokers banished from the house, puffing on their cigars and Turkish cigarettes.
Georgie leaned her head back and concentrated on the cool October air, the scent of mud and drying leaves, fresh and clean after the cloying perfumes of the house. Around them, the trees blazed red, orange, and gold, and in the distance, the hills rose in mottled beauty, rising and falling like the back of a sleeping giant. Georgie felt Bay's hand on the small of her back. Better? Georgie braced her hands against the cool white paint of the veranda rail.
The lobster mousse. It was too rich. I'll be all right in a moment. You can go back if you like.
I'd rather go for a stroll, if you don't mind missing the fun.
Georgie glanced up at him, then regretted the movement, which made her stomach lurch.
Aren't you expected to do the pretty?
Bay drew in a deep breath, letting his eyes close for a moment.
I've done all the pretty I need to do. I'd rather be with you, if you don't mind.
Pining for what couldn't be?
Georgie bit back the words. She didn't have the energy to voice them. And to what end? Anne was married. She would be gone tomorrow on an extended tour of the continent. Months and months and months without Anne. Georgie clung to that thought, feeling a rise of optimism even as her stomach rebelled. They'd been happy before Anne. They would be happy again once she had gone, when the whispers and rumors had trembled to a stop. Anne would be gone, and she would be here. And perhaps something else, which she hadn't quite confided to Bay yet, because she wasn't entirely sure. Georgie let herself lean back against Bay, in the familiar curve of his arms.
If you're sure you won't be missed...
They'll all be busy gawking at the wedding gifts, said Bay dryly. This was a new Bay, a Bay with a bite beneath his gentle manner, a bitter undertone she hadn't been aware of in Paris or London. No one will notice me unless you cover me with sapphires and gold plate.
Or I could just wrap you around with pearls, suggested Georgie, speaking at random through the fog of sickness.
Like Carrie? No, thank you. There were no dead leaves to crunch beneath her feet. The Newland gardeners had done their work too well. Pearls are for tears.
That doesn't seem to stop anyone from wearing them.
The garden was almost too quiet. It was as if even the wind had been warned not to rustle the branches too loudly. Georgie tilted her head back, looking for a breeze.
Or do they think the wealth is worth the sorrow?
Bay tugged at his cravat.
Paris was worth a mass.
Yes, but that was Paris, said Georgie,
and felt a surge of relief as Bay choked on a laugh.
There is that.
He looked down at her, looked as though he were really seeing her for the first time in days.
I miss Paris. Do you?
Picnics in the Tuileries garden, mornings, days, nights together. Uninterrupted.
Sometimes.
There were days when she wished she could turn the clock back, be again in their suite in the Meurice. But was that only memory? Hadn't there been a snake in the garden there, too? And Anne would be in Paris now. Georgie looked at the hills, at the glimmer of the river.
It is beautiful here.
Bay glanced sideways at her.
Sometimes I forget that you were raised in the country. I should take you to Dival's Kill.
Dival's what?
Our house on the Hudson.
Bay grinned, looking like himself again.
Kill is the Dutch word for river, that's all. Peekskill, Fishkill, Miller's Kill.
Dival's Kill?
Georgie tried the name on her tongue and grimaced.
Have you ever thought of changing it to something more euphonious?
Bellamont? The Knoll?
Bay looked down at her, his expression tender, his voice softening.
Illyria?
Even now, even with her stomach churning, even with the gossiping world feasting on their reputations in the dining room of the Knoll, when Bay looked at her like that, Georgie felt herself melting, like wax in the sun.
Are you picturing yourself as Orsino? She mocked.
Just don't go pining after any Olivias.
How could I, with my Viola here before me?
They paused at an elaborate belvedere, a viewing point for the river below. One crimson leaf had been missed by the vigilant gardeners. It rested, ruby red, on the pale fluted stone.
I'll never forget that first time I saw you staggering from the sea, still clinging to a broken spar.
Singing off-key, Georgie provided for him.
Bay touched a finger to her cheek. You sang like a siren. It was the orchestra that was off-key.
Georgie set her reticule down on the broad marble rail. Drunk, most of them. It was the only way they could get through the show again and again.
I stayed sober.
Georgie slid her arms around his waist, feeling her stomach settle at the contact, the warmth of him, the peace. You're something out of the ordinary.
She rested her cheek against his waistcoat, bruising the petals of the flower in his buttonhole.
Your strength is as the strength of 10.
Because my heart is pure?
Bay rested his cheek against her hair. Georgie could feel the rise and fall of his chest against hers, hear the steady rhythm of his breath as the leaves rustled gently around them and the water whispered on its course below. Haltingly, he said,
I'm no Galahad, Georgie.
Georgie tilted her head and smiled up at him, even though her stomach protested the motion. I should hope not, she said cheerfully. He always struck me as a cheerless sort, all that time crusading for a cup, and not even anything at the bottom of it.
Hush, said Bay, but he was laughing. Philistine.
Pragmatist, Georgie corrected. Someone has to be.
Perhaps.
Bay tucked a strand of hair into her chignon, his fingers grazing the opal earrings that had been one of his first gifts to her.
What's your grail, Georgie?
A pint of gin, she almost said. But he would know that for a lie in a moment. Bay? True and not. People changed. People left you. People might not be what they seemed.
She leaned against her husband, looking out at the river.
One last go, Georgie. For a moment it seemed that she could see Annabel, lifting a hand imperiously to her. And then the sun winked on the water, and she was gone.
A place of peace, that was what she wanted. Some place that was really and truly hers.
Right now, a cup of weak tea and a biscuit.
Bay examined her face with concern. You are looking a bit rough. I'm sure Mrs. Newland could find you a bed, or at least a divan.
To loll on like an odalisk?
That would certainly enliven the proceedings.
A new voice spoke from behind them, clipped and caustic. Georgie turned to see one of the groomsmen approaching them. He doffed his tall hat to her.
Forgive me, I seem to be intruding.
Charlie.
Bay drew into himself like a snail hiding in its shell. With practiced courtesy, he said,
Annabel, may I introduce my old comrade-in-arms, Charles Ogden?
The name struck a bell. Carrie Rhinelander's brother. The resemblance was faint, but it was there, in the sharp features, not unhandsome, but with a fox-like shrewdness that put her on her guard. Great friends, Janie had called them, but there was a chill in the air between them. Georgie could feel it in Bay's withdrawal and Mr. Ogden's watchful gaze.
"Comrade-in-arms," said Georgie, holding out a hand to Mr. Ogden. "Were you in the wars together, then?"
"The supposition is not entirely inaccurate," said Mr. Ogden, bowing over her hand. "We were at the law school at Harvard together."
Bay put a hand to the small of Georgie's back, ranging himself with her.
"I hear you've been making a name for yourself at the bar."
Mr. Ogden's face was thinner than his sister's, his eyes more intense.
"You might have done the same."
"My heart was never in it."
Bay's voice was apologetic, but Georgie could feel the tension in him, the controlled stillness.
I still have nightmares about Dean Langdell's case on the law of contracts.
You never seem to mind burning the midnight oil at the law review.
Mr. Ogden's eyes had the zeal of the Inquisitor citing an apostate. Georgie might not have been there, a mere fly on the windowsill.
Your note on the right to privacy, the right to be let alone, is one of the best I've read.
Bay made a slight gesture of negation.
Mr. Brandeis's note, you mean? I only helped in editing it.
The matters of which the publication should be repressed may be described as those which concern the private life, habits, acts, and relations of an individual. It's a powerful idea that a man's private life should be his own.
An idealistic one, you mean? Said Bay. Even Mr. Brandeis admitted two exceptions, and he only spoke of publication in print, not of gossip.
Mr. Ogden took a step forward.
But if one once admits a right to privacy, where might it lead? If the principle could be established...
Would it change human nature? The law can only do so much.
Charlie's eyes burned with the inner fire of the born debater.
Where the law leads, people will follow.
Bay shook his head.
The law might constrain behavior, but it lacks the power to shape it.
This was apparently an old argument, and one in which Georgie had no part. She stepped away from Bay's hand.
Would you excuse me?
Bay blinked and recalled his attention to her.
Are we boring you?
Not at all.
Georgie lied.
It makes a change from hunting stories.
The fox that got away?
Georgie sensed hostility beneath the casual words. Not surprising, she supposed, from Carrie's brother. He looked deliberately back at Bay.
There's a case on that. Pearson versus Post.
Bay cocked his head.
Supreme Court of New York, 1806?
Charlie looked smug.
1805.
Georgie rolled her eyes.
I'll leave you to it, then.
Bay hurried after her.
And leave me to be embarrassed by how much I've forgotten? He'll bring out the rule against perpetuities next, and then I'll be truly lost.
Georgie's stomach was roiling again. She managed a smile.
Perpetually.
Bay looked at her with concern.
I'll walk you back to the house.
Georgie put out a hand, a fleeting touch to his arm.
No, stay. Enjoy your perpetuities. I won't be a moment.
She turned to nod to Carrie's brother.
Mr. Ogden?
Charlie Ogden tipped his hat to her.
Mrs. Van Dyvel?
To Bay, he said,
If you won't admit the power of law to shape opinion... What about the Ten Commandments?
Divine law, not human.
Georgie could hear Bay's voice behind her as she made her way around a hedge, back to the path to the house.
You can hardly compare the Second Circuit to Moses.
What about the Supreme Court, then?
Their voices faded as Georgie climbed up the slope, following the twisting path through a lane of hedges, past the dry twigs of a rose arbor. They had come farther than she realized. She had a stitch in her side. She felt lightheaded. They had had a governess once who swore by a drop or two of scent for dizziness. Georgie paused by a bench, reaching for her reticule, but her wrist was bare. She could picture her reticule, the beads flat and lusterless, resting on the belvedere below. Bother. She rested on the bench for a moment, but people were beginning to drift from the house into the gardens, and she didn't want anyone to find her here like this. She could only imagine what Carrie Rhinelander would have to say. She should, she supposed, tell Bay she was increasing. Georgie let out a little puff of air. She had wanted to wait until after Anne's wedding, to keep the news something between them, not marred by Anne's acid congratulations. Only a few hours more. In the meantime, she could go to the house and make polite conversation, or return to the Belvedere and fetch her reticule and her husband. Annoyed with herself and her traitorous body, Georgie pulled herself up and set off back down the path, the sunshine making rainbows at the corners of her eyes. Only a few hours more. Only a few hours more, and Anne would go off with her new husband in a haze of rice and gossip, and she could retreat to a dark room and nibble very, very slowly on a soda cracker. Charlie and Bay were still standing by the Belvedere. Below her, the men were arguing, their voices low and intense, their heads close together. Georgie could see her reticule in Bay's hand, held in that awkward way men had with feminine things. "Best forgot," he was saying, his voice low. "Maybe you can forget." Charlie's trained advocate's voice carried over the sound of the leaves. "I can't." "Charlie, I told you."
"You mean you ran away? That's not an argument. That's an admission."
"This isn't one of your cases, Charlie." Bay pulled away, visibly agitated, and Georgie started forward, ready to come to his aid, to extricate him from the conversation.
"You can't talk me into submission." "Fine," said Charlie. "Here's another argument."
The afternoon sun glittered in Georgie's eyes, bright on the river. She put up a hand against the dazzle. Charlie grabbed the lapels of Bay's jacket. Bay held up a hand in protest, the hand holding Georgie's reticule. It swung in the air, the beads scintillating, setting up a gentle chime. Georgie opened her mouth to call out, but the words froze on her lips as Charlie Ogden pulled her husband's head to his and sealed Bay's lips with his. In Bay's hand, her reticule swung back and forth and back and forth as Georgie's world narrowed to the glitter of the beads and then to nothing at all. Chapter 14. Cold Spring, 1899. January. Lips on lips, palms on flesh. In the dark, there was nothing but sensation. Janie could taste the whiskey on Mr. Burke's tongue, or perhaps it was her own. She could feel the coiled strength of him through the fabric of his jacket, his hair soft underneath her fingers. Fragments of poetry danced through her mind like crystal baubles, long-dead rogues and roués urging women on to indiscretions, but the words rang like chimes in Janie's head. Nothing— Nothing was here right now except this, except them. Mr. Burke had vowed her no vows, pledged her no pledges, made her no promises, and there was something in that which gave Janie the strength to wrap her arms around his neck, to meet him kiss for kiss, not because he'd asked, but because he hadn't, because this was what she wanted, here, now. His hands moved from her shoulders down her sides, and she felt herself arching to meet his touch as if it were the most natural thing in the world. She felt desirable, powerful, not a spinster to be pitied, but Cleopatra, seduced and seducer. Their lips parted with an audible sound. In the dark, Janie could hear the raw grate of Mr. Burke's breath as he dropped his hands from her hips, taking an unsteady step back, away from her.
"Miss Van Dyvel?"
It didn't feel cold in the hall anymore. Janie could feel the heat between their bodies. Her lips felt swollen, well used. Her hair was half loose around her face. The humor of it all bubbled up in her, the absurdity of such formality when a moment ago they had been kissing as though the world might end.
"Mr. Burke, I presume?"
She could hear him choke on a laugh. Strange to know someone so little and yet know them enough to be able to read volumes into the slightest sound.
"My friends call me James."
Janie remembered the catcalls in the newsroom.
"Not Jimmy?"
"Not unless they want a black eye."
She could feel the cold return as Mr. Burke moved away from her, stepping back with an air of renunciation.
Miss Van Dyvel.
Genevieve.
It had been so long since she had spoken her real name that it sounded strange on her lips.
Or Janie, if you must.
She could feel Mr. Burke's attention. Not Jane? Everyone always assumed it must be. It was a good name for a spinster, Jane.
No, I was named after the patron saint of Paris. My father insisted.
Genevieve. She could hear Mr. Burke trying the name, testing it. He breathed out a long breath, his voice ragged.
I think it would be safer if I stuck with Miss Van Dyvel.
Janie gathered her tumbled hair together in both hands.
Safer for whom?
Both of us. Mr. Burke's eyes followed the movement of her arms, her body.
Miss, I... Damn.
Janie stared after him, her hands frozen in her hair, every inch of her body alive, seized with a heady sense of... what? Excitement. Exhilaration. Power. Power to know that she had made Mr. Burke's breath come short, his hands tremble, that here, in the dark, in this quiet place, someone wanted her.
Are you quite all right?
She was proud of how steady her voice sounded.
No.
Mr. Burke ran a hand through his hair. Janie knew now, knew how it would feel against her fingers, the shape of his cheek, his jaw.
I'm an idiot is what I am. I've let myself forget.
An image rose in Janie's head of a woman dressed in a brightly colored form-fitting frock. A telegraph operator or a stenographer. A new woman.
Forget what?
What you are, and what I am.
When Janie looked at him in puzzlement, Burke gave a snort.
You don't hear it, do you? Even your voice is gold-plated.
My voice isn't gold-plated.
Her voice was just a voice. Either Mr. Burke was more inebriated than she had realized, or he was, Janie thought with a twinge, regretting that impulsive kiss.
No, not gold-plated. Gold straight through. 24 carat to the core. You're so used to it you don't even hear it. You don't need to pretend it.
Mr. Burke sketched an impatient gesture.
You'd best go back to the big house.
And leave you here alone?
I'm not going to steal the silver.
Janie blinked several times.
I don't even know if there is any silver. Anything worth having is probably in the new house.
Mr. Burke shoved his hands in his pockets in a deliberately rude gesture.
Well, that's all right, then. You can leave me here with a clean conscience.
I don't intend to leave you here at all.
How had they gone from let Roman Tiber melt to this? Or perhaps it had been in her imagination all along, a fantasy born of whiskey and wishful thinking. Janie shook her head to clear it, trying to remember why they were there. Giles Lacey. Annabel.
You don't know where the nurse's room is.
I can find it.
In an unfamiliar house, in the dark?
I didn't come entirely unprepared.
There was the hissing sound of a lucifer being struck, sparking slightly before the hall flickered into light ever so briefly, before Mr. Burke swore and shook the match out again.
Here.
Janie lifted an old-fashioned candle in a stand from the side table, handing it to him. Her grandmother had always kept them there, wary of such newfangled notions as gas lamps.
Before you burn your fingers.
I think I already have, Mr. Burke muttered.
He struck another match, holding it to the top of the candle.
Satisfied?
No.
He reached for the candle, but Janie held it back, squinting a bit as the light made her eyes sting.
I'm coming with you.
Now that she could see him properly, Mr. Burke looked as disheveled as she felt. Janie looked hastily away from his lips as he said,
Suit yourself. It's your house.
Janie led the way toward the narrow stair.
I don't know whose it is.
The will wouldn't be read until Bay was issued an official certificate of death. It was a sobering thought, a reminder of why they were here. Not a dalliance in the dark, but justice still to be served.
Sebastian's, most likely.
She heard a step creak as Mr. Burke paused for a moment behind her.
What about Viola?
Resolutely, Janie kept moving forward, looping up her long skirts with one hand.
How do you think the Vandivals have amassed so much? We keep it in the male line.
He caught up with her on the landing, resting one elbow against the newel post.
You'll never catch a duke if you're not an heiress.
I never wanted a duke.
They stared at each other fiercely, green eyes against blue, before Janie turned on her heel, saying dismissively,
Only the new people chase after titles.
Oh, the new people, is it? The ones who have only just made their first million? Forgive a poor, ignorant peasant. I thought every girl wanted a coronet.
Janie's head was starting to ache.
That's as absurd as saying every boy pulls the wings off flies.
Don't they?
Did you?
They faced off across the door to the nursery, the candlelight casting orange shadows across Mr. Burke's face, emphasizing the strong bones of his cheeks, sensual bow of his lips.
No, he said at last. Although I'll admit to swatting a few.
Well, then, said Janie. Don't presume to guess what I do or don't want. You haven't the slightest notion.
No, I haven't.
Mr. Burke stood very still, his eyes dark and serious on her face, as though he were trying to puzzle her out, make sense of her.
Genevieve?
She couldn't very well accuse him of taking liberties when she was the one who had made him free of her name.
This is the nursery.
Confused and annoyed, Janie swept up her skirt and blundered into the doorframe.
All right, then?
Janie wasn't sure which smarted more, her elbow or her pride.
Quite,
she said, and took a step aside, gesturing Mr. Burke to precede her. She must, she decided, be a very bad person, because she took a perverse delight in adding just a moment too late.
Mind the toy soldier.
When he had finished hopping and swearing under his breath, Mr. Burke said somewhat raggedly,
Your nephew forgot his grenadiers.
They were my brother's.
Janie's amusement faded. She could picture her brother lining them up in rows, enacting mock battles. No, not battles. Parleys. Bay had always been more a negotiator than a fighter, relying on charm rather than force.
I imagine my nephew has soldiers enough of his own.
Mr. Burke glanced at her sideways.
Were you a child here?
Briefly.
Janie held up the candle, turning old toys into strange shadows.
The nurse's room is on the far side.
Instead of crossing the room, Mr. Burke wandered over to the wall, squinting at the tiny figures.
What's that on the wall?
Janie obligingly held her candle closer.
Fairy stories? Rapunzel, Cinderella, Jack and the Beanstalk?
She squinted at a sun-faded figure.
The goose with the golden eggs?
She could feel Mr. Burke come to stand beside her.
They killed it, didn't they?
It was a little absurd to be standing shoulder to shoulder, avoiding looking at one another. She could smell wood smoke and old leaves and aged whiskey, and beneath it, soap and skin.
In the story? Yes.
Mr. Burke made a noise deep in his throat.
How many jewels was your sister-in-law wearing when she disappeared?
Too many to count, although many had. Pearls, sapphires, diamonds, strung about her neck, embroidered into her dress— affixed to the heels of her shoes. Janie had an uncomfortable idea she knew what he was getting at. On the wallpaper, the farm wife's hands were around the neck of the goose, ready to squeeze. She turned away, taking her candle with her.
I don't know.
Mr. Burke followed, navigating around the fallen toys.
A king's ransom, the papers said.
You are the papers.
Janie reached for the door of the nurse's room, only to find Mr. Burke's hand on the handle before her.
You should know better than to believe what they say.
Is that what you think of me?
He was blocking the way, looking across at her with a long furrow across the bridge of his nose.
I don't deliberately set out to perpetrate falsehoods, Miss Van Dyvel, even if they will sell papers.
It would have been easier to blame all their ills on interfering reporters, inventing scandal. But the whiskey still had hold of her. And if wine brought truth, how much more so whiskey? Janie let out her breath with a whoosh.
No, I don't believe you do, Jimmy.
Mr. Burke quirked a brow, but moved aside to let her pass.
That's not Queensbury rules.
Janie decided there was something to be said for being under the influence. She made a dismissive gesture.
I never claimed to be a gentleman.
Mr. Burke's eyes swept her from her tousled hair to her dusty hem.
No, you didn't.
He reached at random for the wardrobe door.
This is the room?
Yes.
She wasn't here to spar with Mr. Burke.
I believe this was once the nurse's room, but it looks as though someone stayed here more recently.
Mr. Burke's fingers skated over the wrinkles in the coverlet.
It does indeed.
There was no reason for her cheeks to go red.
A bed was a bed. That was Viola, this afternoon, but the bedclothes were already wrinkled.
Do the locals know the house is empty?
When Janie looked at him quizzically, Burke added,
If someone were looking for a place for an illicit tryst, this would do nicely.
The wall against her back, Burke's hands on her waist, her hips. Janie set the candle down on the bureau and busied herself looking into drawers she already knew to be empty.
Why this room?
Nothing but a scattering of hairpins, a dusting of powder, a stray handkerchief.
Why not a room closer to the landing?
For that very reason. Less obvious if someone came looking.
Burke plucked the handkerchief from the drawer and examined the scrap of fabric, turning it one way, then another. The linen was whisper-thin, edged with lace.
A bit fine for a nursery maid, isn't this?
Is there a rule that nursery maids must have cambric handkerchiefs?
Fancy nursery maids you have here.
He lifted the handkerchief to reveal three intertwined letters, barely visible, white on white, an A and a V flanking a D. Annabel Van Dyvel.
Annabel was always in the nursery.
Janie could picture her sister-in-law in the big rocking chair, Bast on her lap, Viola on the floor, her head against her mother's knee.
She might have dropped it.
Perhaps.
Mr. Burke tucked the handkerchief in his pocket and dropped to his knees before the hearth, squinting at the ashes.
Shine that light over here, would you?
Janie knelt beside him, the candle in her hand.
I saw Annabel in the water.
You thought you saw Annabel in the water.
Mr. Burke eschewed the poker, gently feeling among the ashes with his finger.
Ex pede Herculem.
He was testing her. Or perhaps, she thought with dawning awareness, proving something to her.
I saw no feet, particularly not those belonging to Hercules.
Mr. Burke held up a scrap, blew gently on it, and put it aside.
It's an axiom attributed to Pythagoras. From the part, one can assume the whole. You saw something belonging to Annabel in the water and assumed it must be Annabel.
I saw Annabel, said Janie,
but she wasn't quite as sure as she had been. What had she seen, really? A shoe? A shadow?
You think Annabel took her jewels and fled?
Stopping here to burn her papers and any photographs that might be used to identify her.
No. J.
Janie wasn't quite sure why her reaction was so immediate and so negative, but she knew that Mr. Burke was wrong. She cast about for logic and came up only with, "You said it yourself. Why kill the goose that lays the golden eggs? The jewels Annabel was wearing were only a small fraction of what she might have had."
"And you said it yourself," Mr. Burke countered. "In the fairy tale, they kill the goose."
Janie shifted on her knees. One was beginning to cramp.
"You said that."
"It's true, isn't it?"
"It's a story."
In the story, the farmer and his wife had killed the goose in the hopes of a windfall.
"Even if Annabel inherited under Bay's will, she isn't around to receive it, is she?"
"Who's to say what the plan might have been?"
Mr. Burke was still busy with the ashes, a male Cinderella industriously sorting lentils.
"Perhaps it was meant to look like a robbery gone wrong. The bereaved widow could collect her fortune and marry her lover."
Janie was beginning to be sorry she had asked.
"Mr. Poyne."
Mr. Burke didn't leave off his work.
"Or someone else?"
"No. It made a convincing story, but he hadn't known Annabel and Bay."
"That sounds like the plot of a play."
"Speaking of plays..."
Mr. Burke sat back on his knees, holding a charred piece of paper.
"What's this?"
Janie scooted closer, her skirts tangling around her knees. It looked like a theater program, or what was left of one. The legend Ali Baba Theater ran across the top of the page. Below, in smaller letters, was the name of the manager, half illegible with soot, and below that, larger again, "Every evening at 8:25, the new burlesque in two acts entitled 11 and 1 Nights. Scrolling script read, "The Ali Baba Theater presents," and then in bold, "12th night, up to date." Only the ragged ends of the dramatis personae remained below, starting with, "Viola, Miss Jor—" Janie reached for the scrap.
"May I?"
Mr. Burke relinquished the paper. A bit more crumbled away from the bottom.
"Why save a theater program? And why burn it?"
Janie gently turned the scrap over. Nothing remained on the back but a bit of a colored illustration, a pair of shapely legs in breeches.
"People save all sorts of absurd things."
A half-forgotten scrap of memory from that first summer at Newport, Bay being ribbed about his sudden marriage by Teddy, answering with his usual mix of humor and reserve.
Bay did say once that Twelfth Night had brought them together. I had thought he meant a drawing-room discussion of the play. Perhaps they met at a performance?
Does the Ali Baba sound like the sort of establishment a lady would frequent?
Burke rested his palms on his knees.
"I've been told that your brother and his wife were introduced by a mutual friend."
"Sir Hugo Medmenham."
Janie felt as though she were betraying her brother, laying his secrets bare for strangers. But that had been their deal, information for information. It just hadn't occurred to her that she would have any information to give.
"They must have been in the same party that night at the theater."
"You're ignoring the other possibility," said Burke.
He pointed to the fragment of a name. "Miss Jure."
"Georgiana Smith?"
"That's assuming a great deal from very little."
The world was full of Georginas and Georgianas, a compliment to a succession of kings.
"We don't even know if there was a Georgiana Smith."
"Or is it just that you can't abide the idea of your brother's wife on the stage?"
Janie opened her mouth on an automatic denial, but something in Mr. Burke's face stopped her.
"I don't know," she admitted. "I'd never thought. It's hard to change your idea of someone. Annabel always seemed so reserved."
Annabel had refused to sing in public, even when all the other ladies were taking their turn at the piano. Was it because she was afraid someone might recognize her voice? No. She was building a mansion out of straws, presuming too much.
"There were those missing years,"
said Mr. Burke, as much to himself as her.
Even if everything Mr. Lacey said was a lie, what about those 3 years after Annabel Lacey disappeared? She had to live somehow. Better to sing for her supper than—
Other means? Janey provided. She had worked long enough with the girls' club to know that life wasn't kind for a woman alone in a large city. Yes, there is that.
Mr. Burke lifted the piece of paper, folding it carefully in his handkerchief. Tucking it away, he rose to his feet.
Would you mind if I took this with me?
If I did mind, would you leave it?
Strange how one could know someone for such a short time and still read their body. Burke went very still.
Is that what you want?
No.
Janey took the hand he offered her, wincing as pins and needles shot up her leg.
We made a bargain, didn't we? The truth, no matter the cost.
If we're talking about truth...
Mr. Burke held her hand just a moment too long before abruptly letting go.
Brusquely, he said, "It might be nothing to do with anything, the program."
It was an olive branch, but one Janey couldn't accept. She wouldn't be lied to, even in a good cause.
Then why burn it? You were right. This was something that someone wanted to hide.
Mr. Burke gestured for her to precede him through the nursery.
Yet if they wanted to keep it secret, why all the references to Twelfth Night? It's as if they were taunting the world with it, the name of their house, a Twelfth Night ball.
Don't forget Viola and Sebastian.
Janey drew a deep breath.
My mother was furious when she heard the twins' names. They're not family names.
Any more than Genevieve?
When Janey acknowledged the point with a nod, Mr. Burke added casually,
"She was a very useful sort of saint, Genevieve. Not only did she feed the poor and help the helpless, she's said to have scared the fearsome Attila the Hun himself away from the gates of Paris."
He cast her a sideways glance.
"She's the sort of saint one likes to have in one's corner."
Foolish to feel warmed by Mr. Burke's words. It was only a name. And one she hadn't used in years, not since her father died.
I don't know much about Saint Genevieve.
Only that her mother considered saints' names impossibly popish. Together they crossed the dark nursery, the dim figures of fairy-tale characters looking down on them from the walls.
If we go out the back way, we'll be closer to the garden path.
Lead the way.
But Mr. Burke didn't follow her. He looked at her, and there was something in his expression that Janey couldn't quite read.
"Did you know that Saint Genevieve is generally depicted with a candle?"
Janey glanced automatically at the candle in her hands. Mr. Burke's lips quirked.
"There you have it, Saint Genevieve. They say the devil tried to blow the saint's candle out, but she made it light again. And ever after she brought light into darkness."
Janey had to clear her throat before she could speak.
"That's very poetic."
"And most likely apocryphal," said Mr. Burke briskly. "But it's a beautiful story, isn't it?"
"Yes," said Janey soberly. "A very beautiful story."
They walked in silence down the back stairs, out the narrow door that led into the old kitchen garden, brown with frost, smelling of dead plants with the crisp tang of snow to come. The sky was a slate gray, the moon tinting the darkness rather than defeating it.
"So much for Saint Genevieve bringing light to the world,"
thought Janey, looking ruefully at the candle in her hand, the flame shivering in the wind. Janey cupped the flame to keep it from blowing out. Inside the great house, Mrs. Garrett would be setting the table for Janey's solitary supper. It was bad enough to have invited Mr. Burke for lunch. It was impossible to allow him to stay longer.
"Miss Van Dyvel, Genevieve," he began, just as Janey said too quickly.
"It's late. Shall I have Garrett take you to the station?"
"I thought I might stay here tonight."
Mr. Burke glanced back at the old house, adding belatedly,
With your permission, of course.
Alone?
It was painfully still, the sort of stillness that made the hair on the back of Janie's neck prickle. Still, but not quiet. The night was full of noises. Twigs cracking, leaves rustling, small animals burrowing in the underbrush, and always the river singing on its course.
Are you sure that's a good idea?
Mr. Burke raised a brow.
Are you offering to stay with me?
The idea was strangely tempting. With dignity, Janie said,
I was merely concerned for your well-being.
Very kind, I'm sure. I'm better equipped than you are to deal with midnight intruders.
Do you think there will be?
Intruders? Likely not. But we'll never know unless we try.
She should argue with him, Janie knew. She had no right to allow anyone to spend the night, particularly a reporter. Instead, she found herself saying,
You might at least light a fire. You'll freeze.
I've slept worse places.
Dropping the bravado, Mr. Burke said,
A fire would obviate the exercise. If our intruder sees someone here, he's unlikely to appear.
Janie blinked against the bite of the wind.
Do you know this from experience?
No, said Mr. Burke dryly, from Sherlock Holmes. But the principle seems sound, don't you agree?
Janie found herself laughing despite herself, a laugh that shook with shivers. Had it grown colder, or was it the whiskey wearing away? Impulsively, she put out a hand to him.
Don't freeze on my account.
Mr. Burke looked down at her hand on his sleeve, and then slowly covered it with his own.
Don't worry. You can trust me to look out for my own interests. I have enough whiskey to keep me warm.
A rueful smile twisted his lips.
I don't envy you the head you'll have in the morning.
And you won't?
I'm a hard-headed Irishman, remember?
He lifted her hand briefly to his lips before releasing it.
Good night, Miss Vandyvel. You needn't worry that I'll trespass on your hospitality. I'll be gone before you wake.
Janie's hand tingled where his lips had touched.
Don't be foolish, she said stoutly. You'll come to the house for breakfast.
For a moment he seemed tempted.
I've an early train to catch. Too early to wake you. But I'll leave you a note at the door before I go.
And I'll leave you a basket, said Janie decidedly. Good night, Mr. Burke.
Miss Vandyvel?
Janie turned to see Mr. Burke still standing in the winter kitchen garden, his expression troubled.
Yes?
Sleep well.
Chapter 15 Tarrytown, 1894, October.
Annabelle?
Annabelle!
Georgie struggled out of the darkness with a sick feeling in her stomach and the sense that something was very wrong.
Stop calling me that, she wanted to say. I'm not. Don't you know who I am?
But her tongue felt thick and fuzzy, and moving made her want to retch. A voice she recognized now, low, a whisper.
Georgie.
And then a horrible stench that made her cough and start, flailing against a soft surface that only billowed around her when she tried to push against it.
Stop that!
Georgie blinked open her stinging eyes to see Bay bending over her, one hand chafing her wrist, the other holding a vinaigrette, reeking of brimstone.
You're awake, said Bay with almost comical relief.
His face was a study in relief, but also something furtive, apprehensive.
Why should he?
And then Georgie remembered. She remembered the garden, and Charlie, and Bay.
Get that thing away,
Georgie rasped, pushing the vinaigrette away. The walls around her were papered with blue flowers. They bloomed improbably over the counterpane covering her. She was still in her dress beneath it, her stays loosened but not removed. The ends of her stays poked uncomfortably into her hips.
Bay sat down abruptly on the bed beside her. He smiled unsteadily, reaching out to smooth the hair away from her face.
It's only smelling salts.
Georgie flinched away from his touch.
It smells like the devil's own breath.
Someone made a harrumphing noise. Georgie looked up to find her mother-in-law standing in the doorway, surveying the scene with displeasure. Bay rose hastily, extending the vinaigrette to his mother.
Thank you for the vinaigrette, Mother. Would you mind returning it to Mrs. Newland?
Mrs. Van Dyvel did not appreciate being dismissed. Ignoring her son, she said to Georgie,
You have caused a great deal of bother.
Bay rubbed his tired eyes.
Hardly that, Mother, only Charlie...
Was it Georgie's imagination, or did Bay stumble over the name?
Only Charlie Ogden saw, and he certainly won't go spreading stories.
If he won't, his sister will.
Mrs. Van Dyvel looked pointedly at her son.
She's spread enough rumors already.
Rumors about... But no, Mrs. Van Dyvel wasn't thinking about that. She hadn't seen what Georgie had seen. Georgie felt a crazy urge to laugh. The rumors about Bay and Anne seemed a lifetime ago, entirely inconsequential.
You might, said Mrs. Van Dyvel to Georgie, have shown the prudence to find a place of privacy before succumbing to the vapors.
Georgie levered herself up on her elbows, saying hoarsely,
In the future I will endeavor to save all swoons for more convenient locations.
Bay stepped between the bed and his mother.
It will only cause more talk if we're all gone. Someone from the family needs to see Anne off.
Mrs. Van Dyvel nodded, tight-lipped, and retreated, vinaigrette in hand. Bay sat on the edge of the bed, his hand near but not touching Georgie's.
She doesn't mean to be unkind. She's upset about Anne's marriage. If you hadn't been ill, it would have been something else.
Why in the devil were they talking about his mother? She didn't care about his mother. Georgie turned her head on the pillow, away from him. She could feel the mattress shift as Bay leaned closer.
How are you feeling?
A finger brushed her knuckles, a whisper of a movement. Georgie looked up at Bay, his face so familiar and unfamiliar all at once.
You scared me, collapsing like that.
Don't smile at me like that, Georgie wanted to say. Don't smile at me as though I were a stranger and not a very bright one, someone chance met at a dinner party, someone with whom one had to make stilted conversation until the table turned and one could, with relief, turn to the person on the other side.
It wasn't exactly enjoyable for me either, said Georgie,
her voice rusty. All she could see was Bay and Charlie, Charlie and Bay.
Here.
Bay rose hastily, pouring water from a pitcher into a glass.
Let me help you drink.
The glass was crystal, etched with flowers. Usually Georgie found the casual opulence of Bay's world amusing, something out of a Punch cartoon, too ridiculous to be real. Today it felt all too real, pressing around her. Stifling her. She batted Bay's hand away.
I'm perfectly capable of drinking by myself.
Meekly, Bay proffered the glass, accepting the rebuff without complaint.
Don't, Georgie wanted to scream. Tease me, fight with me, anything but looking so guilty.
Her fingers closed around the glass with difficulty. The room spun as she hoisted herself to a sitting position. Bay hovered over the side of her bed, looking like a golden retriever who had lost his ball.
I shouldn't have kept you in the sun so long.
It wasn't the sun. Georgie took a small sip of water, then another. The cool water felt good against her throat, keeping the queasiness at bay. She leaned back against the pillow, letting her eyes drift closed.
May I?
Bay took the glass from her, gently. She could hear the chink of crystal against mahogany as he set it down,
Mrs. Newland has called for a doctor.
There is no need. With an effort, Georgie opened her eyes.